Tyler Justin, geek from my youth. In this episode of the podcast, I finally get to that part of my planned presentation at JoxCon that I most regretted having to skip over. Tennyson's Idylls of the King. So Alfred Lord Tennyson was poet laureate of England during the Victorian era. He wrote over the course of his life, from 1859 to 1885, a series of poems about King Arthur, which were ultimately collected and massaged by him into an epic which he entitled Idylls of the King. So here I want to back up a bit, because as I think I said at the beginning of this podcast, if I didn't, I should have, I don't come at this subject, at the subject of the Arthurian legends, from the perspective of a lifelong scholar of Arthur, or even from the perspective of somebody like John Steinbeck, who particularly loved and fell in love from his youth with the great work that we've just covered, Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur. But rather, I come at it from the perspective of somebody who fell in love from my youth with King Arthur and his noble knights, the Knights of the Round Table, from some random book that contained the stories of the Arthurian legends retold for, well, for youths, for young boys like me. I don't actually know which version it was. I've unfortunately lost the book. I actually remember it was kind of a, had a mustard yellow color, I think it was supposed to be gold, hardcover. It might have been King Arthur and His Knights by Sir James Knowles, but I don't think so. But it was something like that. It's a famous edition. And it was something like that in that it focused on King Arthur, on his and his knights of the Round Table and their chivalric endeavors, their quests, the quest to find the Holy Grail. And it glossed over the whole portion of the Arthurian tradition, which comes out of the French tradition, as we've seen, and is elaborated upon at great length in Malory, which dwelt on Sir Lancelot and his infidelity with Queen Guinevere. So when I grew up and really re-engaged with Arthurian legend, I was actually kind of disappointed to find out about all these rather unsavory details of Arthur and Sir Lancelot and Queen Guinevere, who in this version that I had from my youth were idealized and then were kind of cut down by the kind of crass and unfortunate and sad and, you know, really kind of adult failings of Sir Lancelot and Guinevere and in Malory, even of King Arthur. So it was actually a delight when I had grown up and was working on my Master's of English Literature at UBC, the University of British Columbia, to encounter Alfred Lord Tennyson's Idylls of the King. Because Tennyson follows Malory, generally speaking. He has some references to Nennius. He talks about Arthur's 12 battles. But he radically simplifies the Arthurian legend in ways that make Arthur a paragon of virtue. And to be fair, why shouldn't he? I mean, we've seen how the Arthurian legend has developed over time out of very simple references to Arthur as somebody who, at the Battle of Badon Hill, drove back the Saxons and then perished, to, you know, somebody who conquered Europe in Geoffrey of Monmouth, but then was betrayed by Mordred. What I was really blown away with when I kind of re-encountered it in preparation for my Doxicon talk with Sir Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur, just that power and the kind of scope and detail of this adventure, was lifelong adventure of King Arthur and his knights, and how he works the infidelity of Guinevere and Lancelot into that as only one of many factors that combine to bring down King Arthur and to cause ultimately his death. Tennyson glosses over a lot of that And as I say, why shouldn't he? This is a legend that's been massaged and changed and adapted in various ways by the French authors, by the English alliterative verse poets, by Sir Mallory himself, and even before that by Geoffrey of Monmouth, in ways that shift and change with the times. And Tennyson is no different. I prefer Tennyson because I think that, well, first of all, I love Alfred Lord Tennyson as a poet, but I think that in Tennyson's portrayal of Arthur, this pure and noble paragon of virtue, we have in its ultimate form an ideal that is worth striving for. And of course, Tennyson, as this masterful poet, this master of the English language, presents it in a way that is powerful and evocative and actually, I would say, faithful to the spirit and the whole thrust of the Arthurian legend. So the main causes of Arthur's death in Tennyson's Idylls of the King are Queen Guinevere's and Sir Lancelot's infidelity with one another, which leads to a general infidelity and a breaking of vows. That's more or less it. So very radically simplified from Mallory, actually focusing on that, you know, somewhat adult, at least compared to, you know, what I was presented to in my childhood, that adult breakdown of relationships due to, lust and all that goes with it. But he follows Mallory in terms of the solutions, if you will, the resolutions of this tragic unraveling of everything with the death of Arthur. In the aftermath, you do have these themes of monasticism, repentance, and prayer. But it's all summed up in this somewhat ambiguous maxim which Arthur gives at the end. The old order changeth, yielding place to new, and God fulfills himself in many ways, lest one good custom should corrupt the world. So, Tennyson's Idylls of the King. We have, leading up to all of this, leading us into the death of Arthur in Tennyson's Idylls of the King, we have this theme of Lancelot and Guinevere's relationship, their infidelity behind Arthur's back. Tennyson, being the good Victorian that he is, doesn't go into any of the graphic details that Mallory touches on. Now, Mallory doesn't go too super into detail either, but he certainly goes into more detail than Tennyson does. But we have it all in the background, and it starts to come out with Lancelot and Elaine. Elaine, of course, nurses Lancelot back to health and falls in love with him. Lancelot cannot return Elaine's love. Elaine then dies because of her love for Lancelot, and preparing for her death, tells her father to place her in this barge, and the barge then drifts down the river to Camelot, where it's actually pulled down the river to Camelot by a servant of her father's household. And Lancelot is presented with this result, this fatal result of his relationship with Guinevere. Guinevere is actually already a bit jealous because she's heard of that Lancelot has been with Elaine. Lancelot has in fact been faithful to Guinevere. He's turned down Elaine's desire to be married to him on the basis that he's a lot older than her, which he is, of course, and would have gotten married earlier if he wanted to. He's promised her everything that he feels that he can rightfully promise Elaine, but because of his love for Guinevere, he will not marry her. And he does her to this courtesy, quote-unquote, all of the discourtesy that he can bring himself to do, of not saying farewell to her. He then brings another theme from this particular episode, that the Idylls of the King are written as kind of almost episodes, if you will, this episode of Lancelot and Elaine. He brings this diamond that he's won. He's been working on collecting these diamonds over 9 years by winning tournaments for Queen Guinevere. He brings it to Guinevere, and he says, "Lady, my liege, in whom I have my joy, take what I had not won except for you, these jewels, and make me happy, making them an armlet for the roundest arm on earth, or necklace for a neck to which the swan's is tawnier than her cygnet's. But, my queen, I hear of rumors flying through your court. Our bond, as not the bond of man and wife, should have in it an absoluter trust to make up that defect. Let rumors be. When did not rumors fly? These, as I trust, that you trust me in your own nobleness, I may not well believe that you believe." So he's asking the queen, Queen Guinevere, his beloved, not to believe these rumors about him. He says their bond, as not the bond of man and wife, should have in it an absoluter trust to make up that defect. Of course, that's impossible. The bond between them, because it's an immoral bond, a bond which violates the deeper bond of that between Arthur and his wife, can't possibly have an absolute trust. This is the natural consequence of their betrayal of King Arthur's faith in them, that they ultimately cannot trust one another. And the queen, Queen Guinevere, says, "What are these? Diamonds for me? Had they been thrice their worth, being your gift, had you not lost your own? To loyal hearts, value of all gifts must vary as the givers. Not for me, for her, for your new fancy." So it's like, take these for the person that you have now fancy over me, says Guinevere. Assuming, of course, that he likes Elaine better than her now. And then she takes the diamonds that Lancelot has won for her and throws them out of the window. And down they flashed and smote the stream that from the smitten surface flashed, as it were, diamonds to meet them. And they passed away. Then, while Lancelot leant in half disdain at love, life, all things on the window ledge, close underneath his eyes and right across where these had fallen, slowly passed the barge whereon the Lily Maid of Astolat lay smiling like a star in blackest night. So the diamonds that Queen Guinevere throws out the window strike the water, throwing up diamonds of water droplets flashing to receive them. Just as the barge carrying the dead corpse of Elaine of Astolat passes down under Sir Lancelot's gaze. This episode here with Lancelot and Elaine also contains Tennyson's kind of rewrite of Arthur's character. Arthur, of course, the arrival of the barge makes quite a stir in Camelot. Guinevere actually asks Sir Lancelot's pardon. Lancelot lets everybody know he would have given up to half his realm to this young girl, just he couldn't marry her. And Arthur happens to mention to Lancelot, you could have actually married her. You know, she was obviously in love with you. She seems to have been made by God for you. And she seems to have been beautiful and pure. She might have brought thee, now a lonely man, wifeless and heirless, noble issue. Sons born to the glory of thy name and fame, my knight, the great Sir Lancelot of the Lake. So King Arthur is completely unaware of the infidelity of Lancelot and Guinevere. He completely trusts them. It's not, as in Malory, him turning a blind eye. He literally believes in Lancelot. And Lancelot answers, "Fair she was, my king, pure as you ever wish your knights to be. To doubt her fairness were to want an eye. To doubt her pureness were to want a heart. Yea, to be loved, if what is worthy love could bind him. But free love will not be bound." "Free love, so bound were freest," said the king. "Let love be free. Free love is for the best. And after heaven, on our dull side of death, what should be best, if not so pure a love, clothed in so pure a loveliness? Yet thee she failed to bind, though being, as I think, unbound as yet, and gentle as I know." A beautiful observation by King Arthur, that free love so bound were freest. That if love is bound by the vows of matrimony, of marriage, that actually frees love to be what it's supposed to be. Lancelot then is struck and feels terribly guilty by King Arthur's trust in him. Arthur talks about the value of his name, and he is now, you know, feeling deeply guilty, feeling that his name is sullied and by his love for Guinevere and his infidelity to Arthur and ultimately to Guinevere, and obviously feeling guilty for the death of the Maid of Astolat, Elaine. And he laments this, wishing that God would, you know, do something to free him from this, but he can't seem to break free of this lustful love for Guinevere, twisted as it is. So groaned Lancelot in remorseful pain, not knowing he should die a holy man. So interesting here. This is where Tennyson ends Lancelot's stories, so to speak. I mean, obviously there's more. This is kind of in the middle of the Idylls of the King, but he points towards the end that Malory mentions, which is, of course, Lancelot embracing vows of monasticism along with Guinevere, and ultimately dying a holy man, repenting for his sins. So that's kind of the beginnings of it. But it's fascinating to see how Tennyson works this one theme all the way through the rest of the books of Idylls of the King, especially in the book The Last Tournament. He builds up to this where he weaves all of these various strands together, the Arthur's virtue and Lancelot's infidelity with Guinevere, and he weaves them together with the story of Tristram and Iseult, which is of course a story of infidelity. Tristram and Iseult fall in love. There's various versions of the story, and the one I remember, they both drink a love potion as he's escorting her to King Mark, to be married to King Mark. And of course, she's pledged to be married to King Mark, and so she marries him, but they are still in love with one another, and they're now in this affair, which Tennyson weaves into this story of the last tournament. There's a tournament to win some rubies, which were found on the body of an innocent young girl. So it's called the Tournament of the Lost Innocence, and there's a dreadful pun there. She's an innocent girl who was lost and died, but it's also a tale of lost innocence in terms of the round table and all that's transpiring. And as Tennyson sets up this tournament, he has King Arthur hand adjudication of this tournament over to Sir Lancelot, because King Arthur has to take his younger knights to go and fight this threat that has emerged to his kingdom, a kind of bandit knight who's set up a kind of mockery of the Round Table, the Red Knight, rumored to be a former knight of the table turned bandit. And so Lancelot is now in charge of the tournament, while Arthur is going off to fight this Red Knight. So Tennyson sets up this excursion of Arthur with his young knights with the message that he receives from the Red Knight, who says to Arthur, "Tell thou the king and all his liars that I have founded my Round Table in the north, and whatsoever his own knights have sworn, my knights have sworn the counter to it. And say, my tower is full of harlots like his court, but mine are worthier, seeing they profess to be none other than themselves. And say, my knights are all adulterers like his own, but mine are truer, seeing they profess to be none other. And say his hour is come, the heathen are upon him, his long lance broken, and his Excalibur a straw." So this is a challenge that Arthur cannot ignore. It's a challenge to his honor, it's a challenge to the fidelity of his knights and his court. And so he takes the young knights to go and deal with it, leaving Lancelot to judge the tournament. This tournament, as I say, is called in mockery by people now familiar with the rumors of Lancelot and Guinevere, the Tournament of the Dead Innocents. And as he's judging it, he sighs weariedly as one who sits and gazes on a faded fire when all the goodlier guests are passed away. Sat there great umpire, looking o'er the lists. He saw the laws that ruled the tournament broken, but spake not. So Lancelot takes on the duty of adjudicating the tournament, but does a terrible job because his guilty conscience is troubling him. And so he doesn't actually go and do anything about all the rules that are being broken. In the meantime, Tristram, who is, because he's in love with Isolde, has actually married another person named Isolde, Isolde of Brittany. He wins the tournament. So here's this knight who is actively engaged in an adulterous relationship, which parallels the adulterous relationship between Lancelot and Guinevere, winning the prize of the tournament of the Den Innocent, or Den Innocence, which is a ruby necklace, of which Guinevere says, "Perchance, who knows, the purest of thy knights may win them for the purest of my maids." The irony there is very deep, that this is not the purest of knights who's the winner, and he's not winning them for somebody who is pure. So Tristram won, and Lancelot gave the gems, not speaking other words than, "Hast thou won? Art thou the purest brother? See, the hand wherewith thou takest this is red." So Lancelot knows about Tristram's infidelity with Isolde. It's another one of the rumors flying around, which is true. And Tristram is annoyed by this. So half plagued by Lancelot's languorous mood, made answer, "Aye, but wherefore toss me this like a dry bone cast to some hungry hound, lest be thy fair queen's fantasy? Strength of heart and might of limb, and but manly use and skill are winners in this pastime of our king. My hand, belike the lance hath dripped on it, no blood of mine, I trow. But, O chief knight, right arm of Arthur on the battlefield, great brother, thou nor I have made the world. Be happy in thy fair queen as I in mine." So Tristram says, "Well, yeah, I won, but it was just might." That's what this beautiful, glorious round table dedicated to chivalry has become. Might makes right, or at least might wins tournaments. And he's annoyed by Lancelot's reference to the rumors about him and Isolde, which are true. And so he throws back in Lancelot's face the rumors about him and Guinevere, which are also true, saying, "Hey, your infidelity is actually greater than mine." Tristram is bound and determined throughout this episode, the last tournament, to kind of excuse his love. He even creates a little song, "We love, but while we may," basically saying, we're all going to die, might as well just love who we want to love. And Arthur's jester, Dagonet, calls him out on this. He says, "Knight, an ye fling those rubies round my neck in lieu of hers, I'll hold thou hast some touch of music, since I care not for thy pearls. Swine, I have wallowed, I have washed. The world is flesh and shadow. I have had my day. The dirty nurse experience in her kind hath fouled me, and I wallowed, then I washed. I have had my day and my philosophies, and thank the Lord I am King Arthur's fool." So Dagonet has been Arthur's jester for a long time. He loves him. He's faithful to him. And in this verbal duel, if you will, between Tristram and Dagonet, Tristram calls him swine. And this is his response. "I've wallowed, I've washed. The world is flesh and shadow." He's gotten dirty in his day, but he's also washed himself. The world is flesh and shadow. The world is fallen, but he thanks the Lord that he is Arthur's fool, King Arthur's fool. Tristram responds, "Oh fool," he said, "ye talk fool's treason. Is the king thy brother, fool?" Then little Dagonet clapped his hands and shrilled, "Aye, aye, my brother fool, the king of fools, conceits himself as God that he can make figs out of thistles, silk from bristles, milk from burning spurge, honey from hornet combs, and men from beasts. Long live the king of fools." Such an amazing, beautiful response. Tristram accuses Dagonet of treason, calling Arthur a fool, is he? And he says, yes, absolutely, he's the king of fools, because he thinks that like God, he can make all these beautiful things from all of these fallen things. which he has. He has done so in creating the round table as this mark of beauty, this bastion of order and of chivalry, of civility, of knights using their might to try and make justice in the world, make peace and rescue those who are the weak in this world from those who are the strong and who would oppress them. He's done this, but it's falling apart. So these two strands then with Tristram and Arthur are then intertwined. While Tristram is dreaming of his wife and lover struggling over the prize that he's just won, the ruby, it turns out in his dream to be frozen blood that melts in his lover's hand, hot with ill desires. And while he's dreaming this, Arthur leads his young knights, who are so angered to see one of their own hanging in shame and ignominy, who has been hanged outside the Red Knight's tower, he leads them to deal with the Red Knight and his bandits. And Arthur leads by example the drunkard knight who comes out and confronts Arthur. Arthur deigns not the use of word or sword, but let the drunkard, as he stretched from horse to strike him, overbalancing his bulk, down from the causeway heavily to the swamp fall. So he doesn't even lift a hand against this drunk knight who's challenging him. But then his younger knights, who watched him, roared and shouted and leapt down upon the fallen. There trampled out his face from being known and sank his head in mire and slimed themselves, nor heard the king for their own cries, but sprang through open doors and sorting right and left, men, women on their sodden faces hurled the tables over and the wines and slew till all the rafters rang with women yells and all the pavement streamed with massacre. Then echoing yell with yell, they fired the tower, which half that autumn night, like the live north, red pulsing up through Aliath and Alcor. So all the ways were safe from shore to shore. But in the heart of Arthur, pain was lord. So Arthur looks on this ignoble slaughter that his young knights have wrought upon the Red Knight and his bandits in their anger. And yes, they have managed to make his realm safe again from shore to shore, but this is not what he wanted. This is not, this causes him immense pain. This is not knightly, it's not chivalric, it's a complete deterioration of the order that he wants to put in place and hopes will persist after his death. And his response echoes Guinevere's earlier response to the tournament. Her and Lancelot's thread is not resolved until the end, but the queen is angry at Tristram and the lawless jousts, break up their sports, and slowly to her bower parted, and in her bosom pain was lord. So she's, her response to Tristram and Lancelot tangling, she's mad at him, she's mad at the lawless jousts that Lancelot has failed to properly adjudicate, and she dismisses the whole thing, breaks up their sports, and slowly goes back to her bower, and in her bosom, pain was lord. So there's this beautiful mirroring there of Arthur and Guinevere recognizing the brokenness of the world, and it causes them great pain. Tristram, meanwhile, awakens from his red dream, goes to see Iseult, and Iseult says of her husband, King Mark, "What rights are his that dare not strike for them?" Again, she's echoing this sentiment that might makes right, and King Mark isn't striking Tristram down, so, you know, what rights does he have? But then there's this exchange between Iseult and Tristram, which again betrays the instability of infidelity. There is no possible trust in that, because it's based on a breaking of vows, not a making of vows or an honoring of vows. So she tells Tristram her response when she heard that he was married. Her response was, "I will flee hence and give myself to God." So she's thinking that she wanted to go and just be a nun. He jokingly replies to her, "May God be with thee, sweet, when old and gray and past desire. saying that angered her. May God be with thee, sweet, when thou art old and sweet no more to me, she says. I need him now, God now, I need God now. Lie to me, I believe. She's actually telling him to lie to her. So she's angry that Tristram is alluding to the passing of her beauty, because that's her hold on him, or at least that's what she feels is her hold on him. Will ye not lie, she says to him, not swear, as there ye kneel, and solemnly as when ye swear to him, this the man of men, our king? My God, the power was once in vows when men believed the king. They lied not then who swear, and through their vows the king prevailing made his realm. I swear to me, thou wilt love me, even when old, gray-haired, and past desire, and in despair. So it's like, yeah, he's kneeling there, he's swearing to her. But didn't he do that to King Arthur? Didn't he kneel before Arthur and swear to him? And she has this sentiment, this sense that in the past, men honored their vows. Men believed the king. And this was how the realm was made. So she says, swear to her, she wants him to swear that Tristram will love her, even when she's old and gray-haired and past desire and in despair. Tristram's response, again, Tennyson is building up this sense that the infidelity between Sir Lancelot and Guinevere is the rot that eats away at the fabric of the realm. And vows are now broken. Vows, says Tristram, did you keep the vow you made to Mark more than I mine? Lied, say ye? Nay, but learnt the vow that binds too strictly snaps itself. My knighthood taught me this. I, being snapped, we run more counter to the soul thereof than had we never sworn. I swear no more. I swore to the great king and am forsworn. The vows. Oh, I, the wholesome madness of an hour. They served their use, their time, for every knight believed himself a greater than himself, and every follower eyed him as a god, till he, being lifted up beyond himself, did mightier deeds than elsewise he had done. And so the realm was made, but then their vows, first mainly through that sullying of our queen, began to gall the knighthood, asking whence had Arthur right to bind them to himself. Can Arthur make me pure as any maiden child, lock up my tongue from uttering freely what I freely hear, bind me to one? The wide world laughs at it. And a worldling of the world am I, and know the ptarmigan that whitens ere his hour woos his own end. We are not angels here, nor shall be. Vows. I am woodman of the woods, and hear the garnet-headed yaffingale mock them. My soul, we love but while we may, and therefore is my love so large for thee, seeing it is not bounded save by love. So again, Tristram here is saying that the belief in the vows that were made to Arthur was what made his knights more than mere men, greater than themselves. And everyone who followed them eyed them as gods, if you will, because they have been lifted up beyond themselves. There's something more than mere mortal about them, because they have vowed to uphold the right. But all of this is undone by the sullying of the queen, because that begins to gall the knighthood. And it's like, what? How can Arthur bind me to himself when he hasn't even got the loyalty of his queen to himself? And Tristram tries to make this into a virtue to Iseult, saying, we love but while we may, and therefore is my love so large for thee, seeing it is not bounded save by love. My love for you is greater than this love which is bound by vows, because it's not bounded by anything save by love. Here ending, he moved toward her, and she said, good. And I turned away my love for thee to some one thrice as courteous as thyself, for courtesy wins woman all as well as valor may. But he that closes both is perfect. He is Lancelot, taller indeed, rosier and comelier thou. But say I love the knightliest of all knights, and cast thee back, thine own small saw. We love but while we may. What then? What answer? It's a good point. She says, well, you know, I could love Lancelot. He's courteous. And yeah, you're taller than him, but he's the knightliest of all knights. I could simply say to you, we love but while we may. So Tristan's response. He that while she spake, mindful of what he brought to adorn her with, the jewels, had let one finger lightly touch the warm white apple of her throat, replied, press this a little closer, sweet, until... Come, I am hungered and half angered. Meat, wine, wine, and I will love thee to the death and out beyond, into the dream to come. So he doesn't have an answer, really, other than meat and wine. That's not really an answer. It's like, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Then in the last light's glimmer, Tristram showed and swung the ruby carcanet, the prize from the tournament, this ruby necklace. She cried, the collar of some order, which our king hath newly founded, all for thee, my soul, for thee, to yield thee grace beyond thy peers. Not so, my queen, he said, but the red fruit grown on a magic oak tree in mid-heaven, and won by Tristram as a turning prize, and hither brought by Tristram for his last love offering and peace offering unto thee. He spoke, he turned, then flinging round her neck, clasped it, and cried, thine order, O my queen. So he's giving her this necklace, calling her his queen, and very ironically saying this, his last love offering and peace offering, because while he bowed to kiss the jeweled throat, out of the dark, just as the lips had touched, behind him rose a shadow and a shriek. Mark's way, said Mark, and clove him through the brain. So just as he's putting this ruby necklace around the throat of his adulterous love, Isolde, Isolde's husband, King Mark, sneaks up behind him and with his sword cuts him right through the brain. This is Mark's way, the sneaking way. It is might of a sort. It's not the might that they honor, but it is a might of the skulking, the secretive. It's low, it's crass, it's craven, but it works. And he's dead. Tennyson continues and concludes, that night came Arthur home, and while he climbed, all in a death-dumb, autumn-dripping gloom, the stairway to the hall, and looked and saw the great queen's bower was dark. About his feet, a voice clung sobbing till he questioned it, what art thou? And the voice about his feet sent up an answer sobbing, I am thy fool, and I shall never make thee smile again. So Tennyson draws these threads together, the love affair of Tristram and Isolde, the love affair of Guinevere and Lancelot, and Arthur's knights, young knights, no longer chivalrous, stained with blood, which is not blood shed in some honorable tournament, but a slaughter, which is just a crass response of power to the slaughter of the Red Knights and his mock order of the Round Table. And as he's coming home, as Arthur is coming home from this, in this autumn-dripping gloom, it's a rainy, gloomy night, he's looking up and seeing that his queen's bower, his queen's room is dark. She's not there to welcome him. And then suddenly this voice is there about his feet. A little Dagonet, his jester, is clinging to his feet, sobbing. And he asks, what are you? And the answer is, I am your fool, and I shall never make you smile again. It's all coming apart. And all because of this root, this rot of infidelity. The next episode, if you will, of Tennyson's Idylls of the King is Guinevere. And Tennyson here kind of follows Malory in that Guinevere does flee to a monastery, She flees to a monastery in Tennyson's poem when Mordred exposes her adultery with Lancelot. So it skips over a whole bunch in Malory. There's no rescue by Lancelot from burning, no angry King Arthur saying that he's going to burn her because of her infidelity. No fleeing from Mordred to the tower, and only after that to the convent. The idea of burning is there, and that Arthur says that he considered burning her according to the law, but he rejected that idea. So it's fascinating to see Tennyson reworking the matter of England, as we say, matter of Britain, that Malory has given him. There's no hint here of Arthur saying, yeah, I could have whatever queen I wanted. What I can't forgive is this destruction of the great Order of the Round Table that has been destroyed here. Tennyson completely flips that. It's actually Guinevere's infidelity with Lancelot that has caused the destruction of the Round Table. And now Guinevere here, before Arthur's death in the monastery, is confronted by Arthur himself. Arthur finds her, comes to her, and confronts her, saying, "Howbeit I know, if ancient prophecy have erred not, that I march to meet my doom. Thou hast not made my life so sweet to me, that I, the king, should greatly care to live, for thou hast spoiled the purpose of my life. Bear with me for the last time, while I show, even for thy sake, the sin which thou hast sinned. For when the Roman left us, and their law relaxed its hold upon us, and the ways were filled with rapine, here and there a deed of prowess done redressed a random wrong. But I was first of all the kings who drew the knighthood errant of this realm, and all the realms together under me their head, in that fair order of my Table Round, a glorious company, the flower of men, to serve as model for the mighty world, and be the fair beginning of a time. I made them lay their hands in mine and swear to reverence the king as if he were their conscience, and their conscience as their king, to break the heathen and uphold the Christ, to ride abroad redressing human wrongs, to speak no slander, no, nor listen to it, to honor his own word as if his God's, to lead sweet lives in purest chastity, to love one maiden only, cleave to her and worship her by years of noble deeds until they won her. For indeed I knew no more subtle master under heaven than is the maiden passion for a maid. Not only to keep down the base in man, but teach high thought, and amiable words of and courtliness, and the desire of fame, and love of truth, and all that makes a man. And all this throve before I wedded thee, believing, lo, mine helpmate, one to feel my purpose, and rejoicing in my joy. Then came thy shameful sin with Lancelot. Then came the sin of Tristram and Iseult. Then others, following these my mightiest knights, and drawing foul example from fair names, sinned also, till the loathsome opposite of all my heart had desire did obtain, and all through thee." Fascinating here, Arthur is referencing in his speech to Guinevere not only the origins of the Arthurian legend, when the Roman left us and their law relaxed its hold upon us, and the chaos that ensues from there, but he's also referencing the chivalric tradition that has been inserted here and putting it in a way that is poetic and beautiful and powerful. He founded his round table on these vows where the knights clasping their hands together in the classic Western form of prayer would have the king put his hands around their hands. So their hands are laid in his. And then they swear. What do they swear? This vow to reverence the king as if he were their conscience and their conscience as their king. So beautiful. How Tennyson has this amazing balance here. Yes, the king is their conscience. They have this oath of fealty to the king. But at the same time, their conscience is their king. So he's not saying, okay, you can just brush aside your conscience if the king asks you to do something against it. To break the heathen and uphold the Christ. So here the Christian tradition is brought in there. It's the heathen who are the force of chaos coming in to destroy and undo all of that Christian civilization has achieved. And they're upholding this. They're upholding the Christ by breaking the heathen. To ride abroad redressing human wrongs. this notion of might making right is to be directly addressed by, in the chivalric tradition, by having might in the service of right. To speak no slander, nor to listen to it. This speaks also to Arthur's unwillingness to believe the slander of Guinevere and Lancelot, his dearest friend and his beloved. He's not listening to that slander because he has told his knights to not speak slander, to honor his own word as if his gods. So the absolute commitment here is to truth and to speaking the truth, to honor your word, and to, having spoken, I will do this, to then enact that and to make it true. To lead sweet lives in purest chastity, to love one maiden only, cleave to her and worship her by years of noble deeds until they won her. Why? Why this commitment to love and marriage? Because he knows of no more subtle master under heaven than in the maiden passion for a maid. Not only to keep down the base in man, but teach high thoughts and amiable words and courtliness and the desire of fame and love of truth and all that makes a man. So this love, which finds its culmination in marriage, its true freedom in marriage, is what teaches, which keeps down the base impulses of man. Which, because you're controlling your lust, you're controlling that desire in the service of someone else, of something else that is higher than you. Teaching high thoughts, teaching men to have words of love and courtliness, to desire fame and love of truth and all that makes a man truly a man. And he thought Guinevere was going to help him to achieve this. And instead, her adultery with Lancelot has undermined everything, till the loathsome opposite of all my heart had desired did obtain. But Arthur doesn't leave it there. He's wanting Guinevere to understand the full impact, the full import of her sin with Lancelot, everything that it has destroyed. But even as he takes leave, he's trying to think how to take last leave of all I loved. His words are of love and mercy. My love through flesh hath wrought into my life so far that my doom is, I love thee still. Let no man dream but that I love thee still. Perchance, and so thou purify thy soul, and so thou lean on our fair Father Christ, hereafter in that world where all are pure, we too may meet before high God, and thou wilt spring to me and claim me thine, and know I am thine husband, not a smaller soul, nor Lancelot, nor another. Leave me that, I charge thee, my last hope. Arthur's last hope is that Guinevere, in repentance, will love him as he loves her. And while she groveled at his feet, so Guinevere is kneeling at Arthur's feet, she felt the king's breath wander o'er her neck, and in the darkness o'er her fallen head perceived the waving of his hands that blessed. So the last action of Arthur, even after his last words to her, is to bless her with his hands, presumably with the sign of the cross. Guinevere's response to all this is also fascinating. After Arthur leaves, she asks, shall I kill myself? What help in that? I cannot kill my sin, if soul be soul, nor can I kill my shame. No, nor by living can I live it down. I must not dwell on that defeat of fame. Let the world be. That is but of the world. What else? What hope? I think there was a hope. Except he mocked me when he spake of hope. His hope, he called it, but he never mocks, for mockery is the fume of little hearts. And blessed be the king who hath forgiven my wickedness to him. and left me hope that in mine own heart I can live down sin and be his mate hereafter in the heavens before high God. Ah, great and gentle Lord, who wast, as is the conscience of a saint among his warring senses to thy knights, to whom my false voluptuous pride, that took full easily all impressions from below, would not look up, or half despise the height to which I would not, or I could not climb. I thought I could not breathe in that fine air, that pure severity of perfect light. I yearned for warmth and color which I found in Lancelot. Now I see thee what thou art. Thou art the highest and most human too, not Lancelot, nor another. What might I not have made of thy fair world, had I but loved thy highest creature here? It was my duty to have loved the highest. It surely was my profit had I known. It would have been my pleasure had I seen. We needs must love the highest when we see it, not Lancelot, nor another. So Guinevere's response, she's struggling with suicidal thoughts, born out of her shame, and realizes, wait, why am I worried about what the world thinks? He spoke to me of hope. And then she's doubtful. Wait, was he just mocking me? No, he never mocks. The king, this Arthur, Tennyson's Arthur, is honor only, truth only, purity, the ideal human being. If there were seeds of the Christ figure, if you will, in the kind of messianic return of Arthur that Mallory actually undermines, but in the legend, Tennyson brings these seeds to fruition in his portrayal of Arthur. And Guinevere's response is to realize that we are called to love the highest. We are called to love that which is most noble, most true. We might yearn for something less than the highest, but that's not what we're called for. And being called to that, when we realize that call, it is a call to greatness, a call to transform the world through that response, that true and loving response to that which is highest. At last we come in the Idylls of the King to the passing of Arthur. Before the battle, Bedivere heard in his tents the king moaning. Arthur is totally distraught by the destruction of all that he has worked for all his life. And this is the expression of his deep agony of soul. I found him, that is God, in the shining of the stars. I marked him in the flowering of his fields, but in his ways with men I find him not. I waged his wars, and now I pass and die. O me, for why is all around us here as if some lesser god had made the world, but had not force to shape it as he would, till the high God behold it from beyond and enter it and make it beautiful? Or else as if the world were wholly fair, but that these eyes of men are dense and dim and have not power to see it as it is, perchance because we see not to the close, for I, being simple, thought to work his will and have but stricken with the sword in vain, and all wherein I leaned in wife and friend is traitor to my peace, and all my realm reels back into the beast and is no more. My God, thou hast forgotten me in my death. Nay, God my Christ, I pass, but shall not die. So Arthur is, as a Christ figure, experiencing this agony of feeling abandoned. As he sees God in nature, but not in his ways with men. Everything that he worked for is undone. It feels like some lesser god made the world, but had not forced to shape it as he would. But his conclusion is, nay, God my Christ, I pass, but shall not die. His God has not forgotten me in his death. he shall not die. There's further echoes of this Arthur as Christ figure. The king speaks later on and says, "My house has been my doom. But call not thou this traitor of my house, who hath but dwelt beneath one roof with me. My house are rather they who swear my vows, yea, even while they break them. Owned me king, and well for thee, saying in my dark hour, when all the purport of my throne has failed, that quick or dead thou holdest me for king. King am I, whatsoever be their cry, and one last act of knighthood shalt thou see yet ere I pass." And uttering this, the king made at the man. Then Mordred smote his liege hard on that helm, which many a heathen sword had beaten thin, while Arthur at one blow, striking the last stroke with Excalibur, slew him, and all but slain himself, he fell. Here dies Arthur in Tennyson's Idylls of the King. His last words are echoing those of Christ. His brothers and sisters are not those who are after his brothers and sisters after the flesh. His house is those who swear his vows, even while they broke them and owned him king. Not this betrayer, this Mordred. And he launches into Mordred. Mordred strikes him on the helmet, as in Malory, a helmet which many a heathen sword had beaten thin, which is why it fails him. And Arthur at one blow strikes the last stroke with Excalibur, so he doesn't run him through with a lance. Like in Malory, he kills him with Excalibur. And all but slain himself, he fell. Tennyson also follows Malory in the episode with Bedivere, where Bedivere is told by Arthur to throw away the sword. He can't bring himself to do it. It's interesting his reasoning here. He is concerned, not as Arthur says, with lust for gold or valuing the giddy pleasure of the eyes. Arthur's actually wrong in his condemnation of Bedivere. He's actually worried that if he throws away the sword, you know, he thinks the king is sick and knows not what he does. If he throws away the sword, what record is there, or what relic of my lord, that will remain to aftertime, other than empty breath and rumors of a doubt? But were this kept, stored in some treasure house of mighty kings, some one might show it at a joust of arms, saying, "King Arthur's stored Excalibur, wrought by the lonely maiden of the lake. 9 years he wrought it, sitting in the deeps upon the hidden bases of the hills." So might some old men speak in after time to all the people, winning reverence. But now much honor and much fame were lost. So spake he, clouded with his own conceit, and hid Excalibur the second time, and so strode back slow to the wounded king. And then he lies to him, of course, as in Malory. Arthur says, authority forgets a dying king, but he bids him go and throw it away, and of course he does. It's taken up by the Lady of the Lake. And finally, Sir Bedivere brings Arthur to the queen's in the barge. And here again, Tennyson parts from Malory in a way that reinforces the Christ-like character of Arthur. Although Arthur, not necessarily being wholly a Christ figure, his response is interesting. It's not as hopeful as one might think, but given the circumstances, it's perhaps not unreasonable that it's not so hopeful. Then loudly cried the bold Sir Bedivere, "Ah, my lord Arthur, whither shall I go? Where shall I hide my forehead and my eyes? For now I see the true old times are dead, when every morning brought a noble chance, and every chance brought out a noble knight. Such times have been not since the light that led the holy elders with the gift of myrrh. But now the whole round table is dissolved, which was an image of the mighty world, and I, the last, go forth companionless. And the days darken round me, and the years among new men, strange faces, other minds. And slowly answered Arthur from the barge, the old order changeth, yielding place to new. And God fulfills himself in many ways, lest one good custom should corrupt the world. Comfort thyself. What comfort is in me? I have lived my life, and that which I have done may he within himself make pure. But thou, if thou shouldst never see my face again, pray for my soul. More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. Wherefore let thy voice rise like a fountain for me night and day. For what are men better than sheep or goats that nourish a blind life within the brain, if, knowing God, they lift not hands of prayer, both for themselves and those who call them friend? For so the whole round earth is every way bound by gold chains about the feet of God. But now, farewell. I am going a long way with these thou seest, if indeed I go, for all my mind is clouded with a doubt, to the island valley of Avalon, where falls not hail or rain or any snow, nor ever wind blows loudly, but it lies deep meadowed, happy, fair with orchard lawns and bowery hollows crowned with summer sea, where I will heal me of my grievous wound. More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. For so the whole round earth is every way bound by gold chains about the feet of God. This is what distinguishes us as men from sheep or goats or animals. We pray for one another, and that prayer connects us to one another, connects the whole world to us, to one another, and to God. So said he, and the barge with oar and sail moved from the brink, like some full-breasted swan that fluting a wild carol ere her death ruffles her pure cold plume. So Bedivere watches Arthur on the barge as it passes slowly away, climbs up to watch as it gets further and further away. It's a wailing on the water. But when that moan had passed forevermore, the stillness of the dead world's winter dawn amazed him, and he groaned, "The king is gone." And therewithal came on him that weird rhyme, "From the great deep to the great deep he goes." Whereat he slowly turned, and slowly clomb the last hard footstep of that iron crag. Thence marked the black hull moving yet, and cried, "He passes to be king among the dead. And after healing of his grievous wound, he comes again. But if he come no more, O me, be yon dark queens in yon black boat, who shrieked and wailed, the three whereat we gazed on that high day, when, clothed with living light, they stood before his throne in silence, friends of Arthur, who should help him at his need?" Then from the dawn it seemed there came, but faint, as from beyond the limit of the world, like the last echo born of a great cry sounds, as if some fair city were one voice around a king returning from his wars. Thereat once more he moved about, and clomb even to the highest he could climb, and saw, straining his eyes beneath an arch of hand, or thought he saw, the speck that bare the king down that long water opening on the deep, somewhere far off, pass on, and go from less to less, and vanish into light, and the new sun rose, bringing the new year. So Arthur passes out of sight, out of the realm of men, into the Isle of Avalon, there to be healed, there to return. In midwinter, but on the eve of the new year. Tennyson's Idylls of the King strikes me as the most perfect Christian representation of Arthur and the Arthurian legend that has yet been devised. Its beauty in poetry is unmatched, unparalleled. As I say, Tennyson is this master of the English language, master of word and word song, wordsmithing. It's wrestling with all the tragedy of our human fallenness, all the apparent meaninglessness of the world, but doing so in a way that has Arthur encapsulate elements of the Christian tradition that Tennyson was able to hold on to, that nourished and strengthened him, that gave him hope even as he looked around him, seeing a dark and decaying and self-destructive world of men. There's something greater, there's something higher. And that chivalric ideal that Arthur embodied is that which calls us to the highest that we are capable of, and beyond that, makes of us almost gods, as Christ said, "Have I not said, ye are gods?" Calls us to, ultimately, that divinization, theosis, that we are drawn up into as we are true, as we speak the truth in love, as we are true followers of Christ, dependent on Him, remembering that God remembers us, that we are not simply dependent upon ourselves, that the world does not depend ultimately even on our own works, but is dependent, in the ancient sense of the word, on the feet of God, bound to it by our prayers for one another, ascending up to Him. This is Tennyson's vision. I think it's a truly Christian vision of Arthur and the Arthurian legend. And, well, I hope in the next episode to talk further about how this echoes and resonates in later developments and even in my own life. I think it's worth leaving it there. This beautiful, splendid, glorious vision of Arthur in a broken, fallen world.